10 a.m. W245 CT Hayward. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. President Biden, who was set to spend the weekend in Delaware, is returning to Washington to consult with his national security team about developments in the Middle East. Israeli officials are expecting Iran to retaliate for the recent deadly strike on the Iranian consulate in Syria that killed 13 people, including several top Iranian military leaders. ABC News national security and intelligence analyst Mick Mulroy on where the U.S. stands.
The United States, although it might have some issues with how the prosecution of the war is going in Gaza, stands totally beside Israel and is ready to defend them as they should, as partners, significant partners, against this potential attack by Iran.
A spokesperson says the White House stands with the people of Australia after a stabbing attack at a mall in the suburbs of Sydney that left 6 victims dead. The suspected attacker was killed, motive unknown. Two bridges reopened in Pittsburgh. They had been closed after 26 barges broke loose and started floating uncontrolled on the Ohio River. This is ABC News. The father of a Michigan school shooter, Ethan Crumbley, starting his prison sentence Friday as the public now hears his disturbing jailhouse rants. Law enforcement say threaten Oakland County Prosecutor Karen McDonald. The Oakland County Sheriff's Office releasing 8 phone calls from Crumbley. More from ABC's Ike Ajachi.
The prosecution claims Crumbley hadn't taken responsibility for his role as a parent before the Oxford High School shooting, where his son killed 4 students and injured 7 others.
They're trying to blame it all on us. They're trying to say none of it should happen because of you.
Prosecutors characterizing the calls as physical threats to McDonald. However, his lawyer says Crumbley was simply venting his frustrations over how he says McDonald handled the case.
She will not have a law license when I get done with her. And like I said earlier, Karen McDonald will be working at McDonald's because she ain't going to be able to get a job anywhere else.
Crumbley and his wife Jennifer each serving 10 to 15 years for their roles in the 2021 mass shooting at Oxford High. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Most of us can agree the decision to have an abortion should be between a person and their doctor. Politicians should have no say at all. Thankfully, Senator Tammy Baldwin is standing up for our rights and working to keep politicians out of our medical decisions. After Roe v. Wade, the court case that protected abortion rights was overturned. Tammy Baldwin introduced the Women's Health Protection Act, which would ensure access to abortion everywhere in the United States, including here in Wisconsin. The bill would end extreme abortion bans that have no exceptions for rape, incest, or the life of the mother, and threaten doctors with criminal charges for providing abortion care. Senator Baldwin also introduced legislation that would protect the right to travel across state lines for reproductive health care and safeguard access to contraception. Call Senator Tammy Baldwin at 202-224-5653. Tell her thank you for fighting back against extreme abortion bans. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Inc.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Wisconsin is having a green energy construction boom. As Mike Moan reports, that's good news for Wisconsin's unionized construction workers.
4 major utilities operating in Wisconsin recently announced a pledge to hire union workers for clean energy development tied to federal incentives under the Inflation Reduction Act. Kent Miller of the Wisconsin Laborers District Council says it paves the way for a smoother transition to more wind, solar, and similar projects.
With the commitment from the utilities to make sure that the wages and benefits are the same standard as legacy energy, it allows workers to focus on updating their skill sets to meet the needs of the project and not worry about are there concessions in wages and benefits.
In earlier phases of renewable energy construction, Miller says some project leaders focused on bringing in out-of-state non-union contractors. Now that Wisconsin labor organizations have a seat at the table, Miller says the next challenge is getting more advance notice before a project breaks ground so they can ramp up recruiting well ahead of time. For example, Miller says a utility-scale solar development requires a lot of labor, and they want as many people as possible to know about potential openings. He says that includes apprenticeships.
Somebody could start their apprenticeship career, complete their apprenticeship, and become a journey worker through the duration of a utility-scale solar project.
He points to the Paris Solar Farm project in Kenosha County, which at its peak had nearly 150 laborers. Of the apprentices, 70% were women or people of color. Analysts say the hiring pledge and associated projects could lead to nearly 19,000 construction jobs that come with prevailing wages. This is Mike Bowen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Tune in Monday to the Devil's Advocates radio show. The trial of the century. Donald Trump will have all the coverage 4 to 6 statewide.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. More sun than clouds, warm and a little breezy today with a high in the upper 60s. Partly cloudy tonight. Low temperatures fall into the upper 30s. And more sun and breezy with highs in the mid-60s on Sunday. Rain chances Monday, Tuesday. It's 60 right now.
Your hometown station for news, talk, and sports. This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
Hey, this is Aaron, the producer for The Todd Allbaugh Show. You're about to hear an episode of Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans, a podcast created by Scott Klug, and Todd and I have been helping work on it too. This is episode 6. Don't worry, you haven't missed the others. We're just choosing some select episodes to highlight what's going on in the world right now. If you want to listen to the rest of it that's out, you can go to lostmiddle.com or look up Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans on anywhere where you get your podcasts. For now, sit back and enjoy Lost in the Middle.
Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans, Episode 6. How the Democrats swapped the headquarters of Walmart to the Republicans for a fleet of Maine lobstermen. The never-ending realignment of American politics.
Oh, happy day.
Well, I bet we have you totally confused in just the first 15 seconds. Those are three brief audio clues to explain where American politics have shifted dramatically. And one thing you can count on, they're going to shift again. And often caught in the squeeze will be America's restless political orphans.
No matter what you do as a political party, you're going to make some portion of your coalition angry. Because we are a giant transcontinental nation, diverse in all sorts of ways, and there is no way to govern in a way that makes everyone happy.
That's Real Clear Politics editor Sean Trend.
So one group comes into the coalition, it makes some other group in that coalition angry, they go to the other party, they're joining up, makes some member of that party angry, and so they leave, and it's just a story that goes on.
Shortly after the 2022 elections, the Blue Dogs, a coalition of moderate Democrats, gathered in a Capitol Hill conference room, a group more focused on national security and fiscal discipline than the average Democrat. In an unusual twist these days, their re-election campaigns often boast of collaboration with Republicans. So where did that Blue Dog label come from? The core group of these Democrats came from places like Mississippi, Georgia, and Oklahoma. Southern Democrats were said to be so loyal they would even vote for a yellow dog before they'd vote for any damned Republican. But then the Democratic Party came to be dominated by coastal liberals, and these centrist Democrats were frozen out by the lefty leadership. One Texas Democrat moaned in another tale of how this name came about. When they left the dogs out in the cold, they'd turn blue. But soon the Blue Dogs got their bite back. Yeah, I know, speaking of cliches, when a proud member of the pack, more cliches and still more lazy writing, Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton's centrist politics got him elected president.
I, William Jefferson Clinton, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
Congratulations.
When Obama got elected, their ranks swelled to 70 members, the deciding votes for a signature health care plan. But by 2022, pummeled by progressives and Republicans, the once feisty bunch was anything but ferocious. So in that meeting in 2022, in a small conference room, they only needed a very small conference room because now there were just 13, not 70, the argument was, about embracing a new name from the Majority Report radio show.
The Blue Dog Caucus, which has traditionally been like sort of like the most conservative caucus in the Democrats, has fractured. Some of them, the women in this group, wanted to rebrand the Blue Dogs as the Common Sense Coalition because the Blue Dogs, that name sort of derived from when they were sort of more a little Dixiecrat-ish. Mm-hmm. They weren't quite Dixiecrats, but they were pretty close. And apparently, like, sort of people still think of it as a Southern boys club.
No.
Historically, the Blue Dogs were Southern and were male, but now its leaders were from New York, Alaska, and Washington State. And now there were nearly as many women as men. How about the Common Sense Caucus they proposed? Well, how did that proposal go? Want to know why it's hard to get anything done in Washington? Six people stormed out of the room to start their own organization. And seven Blue Dogs were now left behind, lonely and proudly defiant. What the hell? You can't even get 13 people to stick together in Congress these days. When I was in Congress, the moderate Republicans were called the Tuesday Group, and we used to meet for lunch on Wednesday, which sort of tells you everything you need to know. If you're lost in the middle, imagine what it's like to try to represent the middle in today's Congress. Al Fromm knows something about the transformation in Congress. Along with Bill Clinton, he founded the Centrist Democratic Leadership Coalition, which, poof, has now all but vanished.
At one point, if you looked at the most conservative Democrat, the most liberal Republican would have been much more liberal than the most conservative Democrat. Now, I think the most conservative Democrat is on the spectrum is much more liberal than the most liberal Republican. So essentially what you have is a more ideological parties.
And that means politicians in the middle get squeezed out and voters in the middle feel ignored. Here's a Clinton campaign commercial celebrating the name of his hometown, Hope, Arkansas.
I was born in a little town called Hope, Arkansas, 3 months after my father died.
I remember that old two-story house where I lived with my grandparents. They had very limited incomes.
There's a main street. There's a courthouse. It's just your typical small southern town.
Hal Bass is a retired political science professor at OBU in Arkansas.
Our high school team would play Hope, and I'd go down there for the high school ball games. And certainly Friday night is a big night in the fall in Hope. The town unites around the high school football team. It's, you know, kind of like Cheers. Everybody knows your name.
The interstate now runs through Hope, Arkansas, so it's grown a bunch since Bill Clinton's days. And when he ran for governor, his politics matched the state's perfectly and the Arkansas congressional delegation.
This was Blue Dog Country here. If you were going to get elected, you had to show you were in sync with your constituents.
Hope, Arkansas is about 8,500 people. George H. Bush's hometown, just about half that size. But if Clinton grew up in lower middle class, the Bushes lived much of the time in an oceanfront mansion in Kennebunkport, Maine. Here's the former president with Oprah Winfrey.
Back in 1902, Mr. Walker, my grandfather, my namesake, built this house, and we love it.
There's the nine-bedroom main house, a cluster of smaller guest cottages, a tennis court, and a pool.
James Melchers, a professor at the University of Maine in Farmington.
Kennebunkport used to be the quintessential Republican town. So the Bushes were very loved in the community. They'd been there for a long time. But Kennebunkport is not Maine. Kennebunkport is extremely wealthy. It's part of the old silk stocking, high education, Republican kind of town.
Main Street in Kennebunkport is more saltwater taffy than Tiffany's, the kind of place where you can buy gummy candy shaped like lobsters and one of those vacation t-shirts that makes you wonder 6 months later, why in the hell did I buy that thing? That's the sound on Main Street when the Bushes came back to the summer White House. The town and the tourists all showed up to wave. But now you're probably asking yourself, why this trip down memory lane? Because now we're going to tell you how the quintessential Yankee Republicans have all disappeared in New England. Case in point, Kenny Bunkport sits in York County, Maine. And in 2020, Joe Biden won the city and the county with 55%. That's right. George Bush could not get elected today in his own hometown. And as for Bill Clinton in Hope, Arkansas, well, here's his ideological soulmate, DNC founder Al Fromm.
How frustrated is your old boss with the progressives?
You mean President Clinton?
Yeah.
We talked a while ago, and he said, you know, I don't think I could win in Arkansas now. So
it wouldn't be close, frankly. In 2016, Hillary Clinton got trounced.
We can say ABC News can project that Donald Trump will win the state of Arkansas. Six electoral votes there, of course, as we said, Hillary Clinton was the first lady of Arkansas for many years. But that has been a Republican state in part because of the trend throughout the South, Democrats losing those working class whites.
And in 2020, Trump won Arkansas with 62% of the vote. And in Clinton's home county, 66% of the vote.
Oh, happy day.
How did this all happen? Well, we have to talk about God and about religion first. The Republicans ripped the South from Democrats by leaning in heavily on evangelicals. And it started with someone who knew Kenny Bunkport very well, George W. Bush.
Preston Bush was a Republican liberal senator from Connecticut that was George's father, had been involved in a lot of liberal causes, was a quintessential Rockefeller moderate Republican, and George was very much that way. In a way, his son wasn't. His son grasped populism more. You know, he said, well, how are you different from your dad? And he says, my dad grew up in New England and I grew up in West Texas. So, you know, that's kind of a passing of generations there also.
And that embrace of cultural issues turned a patchwork of red states in the South into a solid block of electoral votes, including Arkansas, which was one of the last ones to flip to the GOP. Hal Bass, one more time.
The cultural conservatism, I think, is largely a reflection of our abiding rural character. And it was the evangelical shift that I think largely accounts for that transformation.
Yep, we're talking about you, New England. Peter Blute is a longtime Boston radio host and an old buddy from my days in Congress. We shared a small, battered lifeboat together in Congress, Republicans in strongly Democratic districts. He was a Republican from the Boston area. I was from Madison, Wisconsin. Republicans, he says, lost New England in part because of religion.
The New England culture religiously is to, you go to your church on the weekend or Saturday, whatever. You go back to work on Monday. Keep it to yourself.
And up the road from Boston, on 993, is New Hampshire, based on polling, the least religious state in the country.
We saw the Republican Party embrace evangelical Christianity to a hyper degree. You saw this sort of George W. Bush swagger, if you will, this Texas swagger, where he was doing really well in the state of Texas. But that's really when we saw the Republican Party here really devolve.
St. Anselm College political director Neil Levesque.
It's not that we don't have churches. It's not that, you know, people don't pray to God. It's that people don't tell you that they do. So when politicians or a political party is really expounding on, you know, religion and why they're doing things based upon the Bible or one religion or another, I think it probably turns off voters permanently.
When George H. Bush was president, there were Republican members in the House in New England, in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Maine, Connecticut, even Vermont and Rhode Island. Today, there are zip, nada, not a single one. Democrats have fared slightly better in the South, but really not very much. And those who survive are not old-school blue dogs, but largely black members of Congress elected in large cities. Republicans fared better in the South as its economy changed. In Arkansas, for example, in the Bill Clinton era, the state had little industry and its lifeblood was small towns and farming. Now there are national powerhouses here. Hal Bass.
I think Northwest Arkansas in particular has blossomed economically, transformed. I described it earlier back in the post-war era as poor hill country folks. When you got people like Walmart, Sam Walton operating out of Bentonville, a major trucking concern, J.B. Hunt. You've got Tyson and poultry production. I think you've seen Arkansas's industrial and agriculture industrial sector being transformed. And again, to the benefit of Republicans.
And add in huge retirement communities with snowbirds fleeing the Midwest, and according to Hal, usually with a Republican bent. In New England, the story's a little more complicated, where in-migration has tilted it blue. Commuters from Boston and New York added white, highly educated professionals. The days of the romantic maple syrup farmer, largely a memory from old Currier and Ives prints.
This podcast is brought to you by the American Property Owners Alliance. Our country recognizes home ownership as one of the best ways to build wealth and stable communities. But over the years, support for home ownership has dwindled, and our leaders have lost sight of its value. We're working to change that. The American Property Owners Alliance is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that holds our leaders accountable to safeguard homeowners and communities. Visit propertyownersalliance.org to learn more and find out how you can join our efforts.
Remember that sound from the beginning of this episode? That's the sound of a shoe cobbler. And at one time when you slid on a pair of shoes in a store, chances are they came from Maine. But free trade, linked in the minds of those workers with George H. Bush, destroyed those companies.
A lot of northern New England got clobbered by free trade. The coal hand, especially shoes. We used to be one of the biggest shoe manufacturers anywhere. Coal hand, gone. Bass, gone. You go down the list of those things.
Now, here's where it gets even more complicated in Maine. Maine has two congressional districts. The coast, where Kenny Bunkport is, swung hard to Biden and has a Democratic member of Congress. But the interior of the state became Trump country because he was the guy who punched back with steep tariffs, hitting China and Southeast Asia, today's shoe manufacturing centers. Here's a PBS story about one of those cities and a one-time mill worker and a city council member.
In 2016, Donald Trump won the second congressional, which includes Millinocket, making him the first Republican since 1988 to gain an electoral vote here. He won the district again this year.
The Democrats, why did they lose strength there in your part of the world?
I think they lost touch with the people. The Democratic Party, you know, growing up seemed to be more for the working class, and I think it's kind of turned now. I think now the Democrats have lost touch with the average person, and President Trump has brought the Republican Party, turned it right around. It's always been said there's two Maines, and I firmly believe there is two Maines.
You know that feeling when you walked off a tilt-a-whirl when you were a kid and everything was spinning around? Well, we're going to make you climb back on that ride just one more time. And so while New England's congressional district and its state legislatures are solidly blue, its governors are not. In recent years, it's been overrun by Republicans. New Hampshire Republican John Sununu is arguably the second most popular governor in the country. His next-door neighbor, Republican Governor Phil Scott, in Vermont, in the land of Bernie Sanders, was recently reelected to his fourth term.
He's a guy who's, worked in the construction business. That's what his background has been. He drives dirt track NASCAR type cars that he builds himself. He's like a regular guy that people have known, and his family's been in the community for a long time.
Dr. Alan Iceman is originally a New York City doctor who decades ago joyfully moved to more laid-back Vermont. He's a loyal Democratic voter, but he likes having an old-fashioned Republican keeping the Democratic legislature from reaching too deeply into his wallet.
And people like that he's a very fiscally responsible, straightforward person who doesn't want to raise taxes unnecessarily, which the state legislature in its Democratic way sometimes has tried to be more spending-oriented than Phil Scott has wanted them to be. So I think that's what people like about him, is They don't want their taxes to go up. They want an appropriate explanation for how you're going to use the money. And he's always kind of held people to the task of saying, if we don't have the money, we can't really do this. We can't just tax our way out of these problems.
Before he left office last year, Republican Governor Charlie Baker was the most popular governor in America. And Pete Bluth says it's that same fiscal dynamic.
This is the thing. You need fiscal sanity in a legislative chamber and a governorship. And the Republicans in New England were able to bring that. They reassured the average person that even though I might not agree with Sununu or Weld 100%, I know there'll be a backstop, a fiscal backstop to keep things under control. And many, many tax increases were vetoed by those moderate governors. And the average person in these states said, thank you.
But as we've told you, the national GOP has abandoned that focus on fiscal issues. Want to know how weird it is in Massachusetts? When Charlie Baker, America's most popular governor, refused to put up a picture of Donald Trump in his office, at the state GOP headquarters, its leadership refused to put up a picture of its own Republican governor.
It's no surprise that the two parties at this point have become further and further away from the middle. And so what have voters done? They have reacted in a way that they, a lot of the voters that you find that are undeclareds, are proud of the fact that they are undeclareds and that they are focused on the person rather than the party. And a lot of people are disgusted by both parties at this point, and so that's what they become. So again, the largest voting bloc in New Hampshire is the undeclareds.
That's Neil again.
The Republican Party has started to die on the vine. And it hasn't reacted by saying, okay, what are we going to do here to start winning again, to increasing that number? Instead, it said, we're great, we're Republicans, we're losing, but we're still Republicans or we're members of this tribe, and we feel good about it. Well, that's great, but you're not going to win elections.
And now let's have some more fun and slap around the Democrats for a while. You know, the Democrats have fixated on demographics for some time. The theory goes, young people today are Democrats, the suburbs are turning more purple, the percentage of older white voters is shrinking, and voila, the Democrats will rule the world. Elaine Komarek was part of the Clinton Blue Dog wave, and she warns Republicans, those headlights, they're heading right at you.
I think demographics are destiny. The problem is that it's glacial. You know, demographic movements are really, really glacial. There will be a point when we wake up in Texas and say, oh my God, Texas is blue. You and I may not be around, okay? And the reason you know what's going to happen is that there is such an age divide.
In 2002, prominent Democratic strategist Rui Tejera made that exact argument in a book called The Emerging Democratic Majority. It was a wildly popular book and celebrated breathlessly in the opinion columns in the New York Times and the Washington Post. But in the end, the conclusions were flawed. Well, who says that? Who has the audacity? The guy who wrote the book. His models were based on the idea that Democrats would hold on to all the voting blocks it had in 2000, but it would capture, for example, the surge of Hispanic voters. Except the Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away. Rui Tejera is a demographer and a Democratic strategist.
So basically now you have the people who run the Democratic Party, the people who run associated institutions, people who run the nonprofits, the advocacy groups, the foundations, and of course, even in academia, we see this in spades. They're pretty left, and they're pretty culturally out of touch with the ordinary American. And that really helps define the party brand. It just does. I mean, Democrats are associated with a whole range of boutique positions and obsessions that just don't correspond to what most ordinary Americans, particularly working class Americans, care about. Yeah, the Blue Dogs are a victim of, you know, basically the desertion of primarily the white working class from the Democratic Party.
Case in point, Hispanic voters are disproportionately blue collar workers, and perhaps more than any other group in the country, were clobbered by the COVID shutdown imposed by the Biden White House.
I think people underestimate the extent it pissed off a lot of working class voters, particularly, you know, especially Hispanics who tend to be low-level service workers, that the economy was kept closed for so long in so many places. And Republicans really benefited from that. So, In other words, it's sort of, if Hispanics have a presupposition as seeing Democrats as being the party that's on their side and cares more about them, that's being undercut by a lot of these other issues that are coming up that are tilting the Democratic brand away from sort of the wheelhouse of the normie Hispanic working class voter, to the point where there's now a permission structure for them to vote Republican more so than they used to.
So where does that leave America's political middle? One more ingredient in the stew that is American politics in 2024. You can argue about how big that segment is, but you can clearly tell how frustrated they are with America's extreme political leaders.
Yeah, I wouldn't belabor that point too much, I guess, about how big or small today's middle is relative to the past. But I think we could fairly say it's substantial, and they're kind of pissed off, basically. There's always been a middle that's felt dissatisfied, but they're now more dissatisfied, and it's a bigger political problem. It's a bigger problem for the country because of the way the parties have become so polarized and their inability to address some of the issues that Americans care most about and to be more in the sort of cultural center.
We're told it frustrates former President Bill Clinton because his whole campaign and his entire congressional strategy was based on straddling the middle. But there's not much room for it in national politics these days. Here's the one-time leader of his posse, Al Fromm, one more time.
I'm sure he's concerned about it because he understands that, to win, Democrats have to, and to hold the Congress, we have to win in districts that would ordinarily go Republican. And you do that by winning swing voters who are in the center, and you can't do it if you take progressive positions. I think the Republican moderates face a more difficult problem than the conservative Democrats.
By now you're wondering, wasn't there a third clue? Let me see, there was the gospel singers, then there was a Maine cobbler, and wasn't there a third? Here it is now. That's the spinning wheel on a game show. No one knows where it's going to land. Not Vanna on Wheel of Fortune, not on a Midway Carnival, and not in American politics. We can only tell you it never stops spinning. And the lost middle, bewildered as always, frustrated with the extremes, just now more so than ever before. So take away one lesson from these stories. Anyone who tells you how people in California, in Mississippi, in Montana, in Nebraska, in Pennsylvania will vote 20 years from now, they really don't have a clue.
It's just a story that goes on. As a matter of fact, a big picture thing to keep in mind is that if you go back to the 1850s, to the founding of the Republican Party, the parties have won the presidency exactly 50% of the time. It's almost as if our elections are governed by coin flips. And the reason is that you just cannot create a dominant party in this country. Because we're so diverse, there's so many factions. It's just always going to balance out in the long run.
So if the political chaos around you makes you feel frustrated by the current political zeitgeist, if you're part of America's bewildered 71 million common sense voters, you can count on one thing in American politics. The headwinds are always shifting. So hang on tight to your principles. They're soon going to shift around and be at your back.
And if, when you're running, it seems the wind is always in your face, just keep on running, 'cause the wind is bound to change. Hold on with all your strength.
Here's the team behind Lost in the Middle. Executive producer Jeff Mayers. Producer Todd Elbaugh. Creative team Claudia Luz and Tony Wood. Edited by Aaron Zummers. Music by Brett William. Production at Civic Media. And a quick thanks to our partners at the American Property Owners Alliance. If you like this episode of Lost in the Middle, please remember to subscribe to our podcast. And if you enjoyed it, please tell your friends and pals.
Just keep on dancing with the one who brought you. And keep running, 'cause the wind is bound to change.
Change. Hayward's choice for news, talk, and sports. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. President Biden, who was set to spend the weekend in Delaware, is returning to Washington to consult with his national security team about developments in the Middle East. Israeli officials are expecting Iran to retaliate for the recent deadly strike on the Iranian consulate in Syria that killed 13 people, including several top Iranian military leaders. ABC News national security and intelligence analyst Mick Mulroy on where the U.S. stands.
The United States, although it might have some issues with how the prosecution of the war is going in Gaza, stands totally beside Israel and is ready to defend them as they should, as partners, significant partners, against this potential attack by Iran.
A spokesperson says the White House stands with the people of Australia after a stabbing attack at a mall in the suburbs of Sydney that left six victims dead. The suspected attacker was killed, motive unknown. Two bridges reopened in Pittsburgh. They had been closed after 26 barges broke loose and started floating uncontrolled on the Ohio River. This is ABC News.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
The Bucks lose to the Thunder. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks were without Giannis and Damian Lillard. They lost to the Thunder in Oklahoma City. The final 125-107. Bucks head coach Doc Rivers.
Yeah, I thought early on we were pretty good. I thought the second quarter we started trying to make too many guys are making plays that shouldn't try to make plays, and we turned the ball over. First quarter, I loved the ball movement. We played downhill a lot. We played through our bigs. We moved the ball, and it was good basketball. Then after that, it looked like guys, everybody who grabbed it tried to make a play, and it's just not who most of them were. But you know, we got a good burn, which I thought was we'd love that one, but I wanted to burn some minutes, and we did that.
The Bucks could still clinch the number 2 seed in the conference with a win tomorrow in Orlando against the Magic. That's the final game of the regular season. Baseball, the Brewers cruised to an 11-1 win over the Orioles. At 9-3, Milwaukee in first place in the NL Central. The series continues in Baltimore. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. More sun than clouds, warm and a little breezy today with a high in the upper 60s. Partly cloudy tonight. Low temperatures fall into the upper 30s. And more sun and breezy with highs in the mid-60s on Sunday. Rain chances Monday, Tuesday. Currently at 62 degrees.
The Todd Alba Show.
Luke, I'm just going to say it again. The real problem here was that goofy in-season soccer tournament that they had. That threw everything
That's
off.
What are you talking about? That was December basketball. You just couldn't figure out the rules.
You're exactly
Todd.
Right. There are goofy rules I couldn't figure out. I don't like them.
You would not do well with driving on the left-hand side of the road.
Oh, absolutely not.
You would just start freaking out.
Yeah.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Rice Lake's choice for news, talk, and sports. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
If you're just tuning in, you've been listening to Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans on Civic Media. Now here's some bonus content from this episode with Scott and Todd.
Scott, so here we are about a week out from the South Carolina primary. Nikki Haley is still in this thing as far as presidential politics. You got Trump maybe a little nervous as we head into South Carolina. You got Nevada after that, and then Super Tuesday. What's your take on realignment and how this is going to affect the 2024 Republican primary?
Well, the interesting thing, Tyan, I think people always have this sense that American politics are static and it's anything but. We were just laughing beforehand because I remember when I was in high school, we'd end up oftentimes on Friday nights, losers we were, dateless, playing Risk till 2 o'clock in the morning.
It's a great game.
It is a great game. But if you remember Risk, if you play it, it's a map of the world and the whole goal is to sort of conquer stuff as you go. And throughout the game, you start in Europe and suddenly you're dead in Europe, but now you got countries in Africa. Or I was thrilled about 7 or 8 months ago flying to South Korea for a conference, and I looked at the map on my the back of the airline seat in front of me, and we're flying over Kamchatka and Irkutsk, which are two weird little corners of Northeast Asia that I never really paid attention to where they were. So it brought back Risk memories. But if you think about that, think about the New England primaries. If you go back to when George Bush was president and when he ran, the Northeast was pretty heavily moderate Republican Yankee country. And today, George Bush couldn't get elected in Maine. And then if you look at the Southeast, you know, Bill Clinton is in Arkansas. The whole Southeast is Clinton's key to getting elected president as a moderate Democrat. And not only would he not get elected in Arkansas, he'd get killed in Arkansas. The numbers were like in the high 60s for Donald Trump last time out. And it was almost that high when Trump ran against Biden in 20. So it's a never-ending shift in American politics. And as Nikki leaves New England, which should have been favorable territory, she now gets to go through a death march largely through the South, which is where the Republican Party is largely based today. You know, you sort of had the Republicans trade the, you know, New England Maine lobster fishermen and Vermont maple farmers for essentially the headquarters of Walmart and the University of Arkansas in Georgia. I mean, it's a very different cultural experience. So I think that's really the lesson of this realignment story that we've done. And Sean Trenz, a tremendous demographer and the editor at Real Clear Politics, and he had actually a lot more to say about how the country's changed over the years.
Yeah, I mean, and this is the cool thing we get to do on radio is, because podcasts have to be kind of a certain length, and you've kind of cut that down to make it listenable, but we have a little bit more time on radio, and so it's kind of, you know, things that you didn't get to hear in the podcast behind the scenes, so to speak.
So how about if we go to Sean and listen to how American politics has realigned since the founding of the country?
Well, talk to me about what drives that, and what kind of role does demographics play, and migration play?
It's obviously a complex story. You know, there's a demographic angle to it. You know, the giant third wave of immigration, which was the immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe in the late 1800s and early 1900s, were Democrats, Catholics. And as they had kids, their numbers started to kind of overwhelm the old Republican WASP base in New England. But a large part of the story, it's funny, if you look at the Connecticut congressional delegations in the 1910s, it's like there would be a Republican group and there would be members like Lonergan and, you know, Thomas, those would be the surnames. And then there would be a Democratic wave. All the Republicans would lose and it would be Democratic names like O'Reilly and O'Scanlan. And you could really see how like ethnically cleaved that state was. But a lot of it, too, is this story that I just told about, you know, Southern Democrats exiting the Democratic Party as it became more hospitable to civil rights. Well, those voters go somewhere. And so they go to the Republican Party and they start voting in Republican primaries and some of them get elected to Congress. And, you know, it turns out that the, you know, liberals in New England, the Jacob Javits of the world, aren't that comfortable being in a coalition with Jesse Helms. And so while Jacob Javits stayed with the party, you know, people like him and their kids would start leaving because they're like, whatever the Republican Party was, it's not me. In the same way that the Southern Democrats were saying, whatever the Democratic Party used to be, that's not who I am today. And so go ahead. As you like, one of the big stories of the 1994 election was you all of a sudden had a Republican leadership that was all from the South, right? You had Gingrich, DeLay, and Armey. And as the Republican Party got this Southern face and became more and more conservative, it became difficult for people like Blute and Torkelson to win New England. You know, blacks were historically Republican coalition members, you know, going back to the Civil War. Why did they become Democrats? And kind of the pat response you get is the Civil Rights Act. But the truth is, the last Republican to carry the black vote was Herbert Hoover in 1932. And what happened is just an example of one of those flukes of history, that the New Deal helped all boats rise, especially poor people. And in this country, you know, blacks are and still are, were and are, disproportionately poor. And so they actually flipped their voting in 1936. Well, the Southern Democrats weren't real happy about having black voters in their coalition. The first racial walkout was actually in the 1936 Democratic Convention, where a black pastor gave the invocation. And so that's just a really nice example of a group coming into the party coalition almost by accident, and it's starting the exodus of another group.
And talk to me about Georgia, just because I think that's an interesting case, because there's a situation clearly moved by demographics, right? That Atlanta has now become a magnet for Black professionals in the South. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that is clearly part of the story of what went on in Georgia. Another part of the story is Donald Trump. You know, places like Buckhead and I can't think of the big kind of old school, Dunwoody. Places like that would have been solidly Republican 20 years ago, and today they're not. The biggest swing in any congressional district from 2012 to 2020 was that Georgia 6th district. It swung like 30 points at the presidential level. And a lot of it is just white professionals deciding they've had enough of the Republican Party. Once Donald Trump takes the stage and, you know, the Republican Party starts to be recast in his image. So Georgia is kind of a perfect storm of bad news for Republicans, because you have the growth of the non-white population, you have the big swing in the suburbs, and, you know, you have the city of Atlanta just growing like crazy. Republican gains among white working class voters in Georgia just aren't enough to offset that.
Yeah, it's interesting because Buckhead and those suburbs are actually where ticket splitting surge. You know, talking about Arizona and Nevada, about 3 weeks ago, Nevada became more independents registered than any other party. And so talking about those two states, and then talk to me about sort of the emergence of independents. Is this a real thing, or is this just sort of an anti-Trump thing?
Yeah, God bless the senators and governors of Nevada, because they have to run in a whole new electorate every 4 or 6 years, because the state's just, you know, growing so crazy. And because it's still a relatively small state, but it's growing quickly, it gets remade very swiftly as well. And so you have a large Hispanic population, which over the last, you know, 6 years or so has trended towards Republicans. I don't think very many people will dispute that anymore. And there's a large working class base in the casinos and the service industry, and it's trended Republican as well, and kind of stopped, you know, getting back emerging Democratic majority. Rui and John had picked up on Nevada swinging towards the Democrats, and it swung hard between 1992 and 2008. But since then, it's drifted back towards the Republicans. And part of that is the growth of independents. You know, a lot of independents are what political scientists call closet partisans. You know, they say they're independent, but when you come down to it, they're like, yeah, but I voted for Republicans in 15 straight elections. You know, but they like the idea of being kind of having their own mind that just always happens to come out the same way. At the same time, though, it's a weakening. I think political scientists and social scientists take that too far, because there is a weakening of attachment to institutions.
Well, the other thing you hear, and I just went through this with the Democratic academic who made the argument to say, well, the Democratic majority is coming because if you look at young voters today, they're largely Democratic. And therefore, as they go through life, they'll stay Democratic and it'll be a huge majority. But the trend still holds, right, that as people get older, they shift to be more conservative.
They do. And if you look at millennials, if you look at the generation that voted for Barack Obama, like 65 to 35 in 2008, they're split now between the parties. Gen X is swinging more towards the Republican Party. And it's not necessarily that people's views change radically, it's that the asks get more and more aggressive, you know. And so the kind of cleavages in 2008 were things like marriage equality or gay marriage, and today young Republicans are in favor of it. You know, that's an issue that's just not going to be one in 10 or 20 years. Now it's things like transgender rights, where it wasn't even on the radar screen in 2008. And so, you know, a 40-year-old millennial encountering this for the first time is kind of writing on a blank slate. So We've just heard this song and dance about the emerging Democratic majority now for inevitably coming for 20 some odd years now. And at some point it has to come, right? Republicans still control the House and are leading for the presidency, believe it. I mean,
that was Sean Trend of Real Clear Politics. And Scott, a couple of things that stuck out for me. Number one, this generational shift. And I think he brings up a good point, right? I mean, I remember, you know, there was a time when I was in the Republican Party where you just didn't talk about sexual orientation. And now, to a lot of people, it's not a big deal. There's certainly still a Christian right part of the party. It is a big deal, but we've seen a shift away from that. It makes you wonder in 20 years or so where the parties are going to be, assuming there still are two major parties, what it's going to be like.
Well, I think that's a fair question. So if you look at people under the age of 30, they don't affiliate with parties. They don't like either of the parties. Now, if you actually went down sort of issue by issue, they're probably lean more left than they lean right. Which is not surprising because, you know, when I was a college kid, I voted for George McGovern because I didn't want to vote for, you know, Richard Nixon. It wasn't much of a choice for me. And so I think that's true. As you move through life, it meant life gets more complicated. Suddenly you're worried about schools and houses and taxes and, you know, just sort of the crush of everyday life, I think, take triumphs over a lot of social issues. But it's, you know, it's clearly true that even if you look at younger Republicans, the gay marriage issue, a lot of the other issues around transgender and gender are largely settled. And in their mind, it's not even an issue to discuss because that's what they've grown up with. And so the Republican Party has some demographic challenges going forward. But as you heard in Sean's thing, you know, so if you look, everybody thought the Hispanics would trend more Democratic. Hispanics, especially in the Southwest and other places in the country, are largely manual labor, hold manual labor jobs. They're a big part of the workforce that's uneducated, hardworking, pay taxes, do great things, but they got crushed by the COVID shutdown. It's the single demographic group in the country that had the hardest time, which is now why you see what were assumed to be the safe Democratic districts in Texas now are trending Republican. And the Republicans are winning them on the border because the Hispanic voters on a lot of immigration issues, as well as social issues, because a lot of them are Catholics, it's trending more and more Republican. And the other big shift I think I see that's pretty clear, and we'll talk about Wisconsin because you and I are based here, the core of the Republican Party support in the state of Wisconsin for years were a series of suburbs that surround Milwaukee County. Very, very heavily Republican. It was the core base for Governor Thompson when he was elected. It was the core base for Scott Walker when he was governor here. That's completely shifting in the other direction. And it's really driven largely by suburban women who are concerned about social issues, but also concerned about Trump's sort of profile and attitude towards women. And the question for Republicans will be, if and when Donald Trump's gone, do those voters come back or is that a permanent shift?
You talked about it in the podcast, bringing it back to Wisconsin, where we're based. I mean, you represented, when you were in Congress, South Central Wisconsin, including Madison, arguably the most liberal city in the state of Wisconsin. You also had a lot of rural counties, and that's where you kind of cleaned up with 70% plus. But I don't know that you could get reelected in that district today.
Well, if you heard in the podcast itself, if you listen closely, I meant George Bush could not get elected in Maine today. Bill Clinton would get clobbered in Arkansas. And clearly with the shift here, I don't think there's a chance in hell I'd get reelected. Although,
but you're still a likable guy.
Yeah, I am a likable guy.
But to people that don't know, you are a pro-choice Republican. You also were the few Republicans that voted for Clinton's assault weapons ban. You were just more of a libertarian, you know, conservative fiscal guy. I still think that sells, but because the way the maps are drawn, I'm not sure you can get reelected.
No, you're not hurting my feelings, but that's just the political reality of it. Now, the other thing that happens, though, a lot of the Midwestern states, as they lose population, it means they'll lose House seats. I don't think Wisconsin's there yet, but some other states will. And even with the Madison district, if you start to spread it out, then suddenly it gets more competitive again. But Madison, for folks who don't know, in Dane County, is one of the fastest growing counties in the country and also by far the fastest growing county in the biggest demographic bubble. So Republicans in Wisconsin, just talking about shifts,
suddenly now have challenges, right? Because they're eroding in their suburban base around Milwaukee. And I don't know what the deepest color of blue is in your crayon box, but that's what Madison is today. But on the other hand, if you look at other parts of the state, the far northwestern corner, which sort of goes from the center of the state up towards Lake Superior and borders Minnesota, is arguably one of the two or three most Trump districts in the entire country. Mm-hmm. And on the western side of Wisconsin, that goes basically from the Illinois-Iowa border and sweeps up towards Minneapolis, just flipped from a Democratic seat to a Republican seat, largely because of suburban Minneapolis voters who are frustrated with Minnesota's very left politics and move to vote more Republican in Wisconsin. So wherever you live, wherever you're listening to this, like a giant risk game, you know, the pieces keep moving. Today you're in Kamchatka. Tomorrow you might be in North Africa. But it's the way American politics have been for hundreds of years.
Scott, we'll catch up with you next time. Always appreciate it. You've been listening to Lost in the Middle right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Sawyer County's choice for news, talk, and sports. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
Coming up Monday on Matt Nair On Air, three headlines and a lie, and it's tax day. I hope you'll join us.
A fourth-generation family-owned business is running strong thanks in part to Wisconsin cheese. Dufek Wood Products calls Denmark home and has been based in northeast Wisconsin for close to 120 years. It's best known for manufacturing boxes, which are food-safe to age and ship wheels of cheese and can be reused. But another Dufek Wood product is getting attention thanks to the Guinness Book of World Records. Do you think it's the family's wine boxes, organic garden mulch, or charcuterie boards? The answer coming up. Winter logging for summer building supplies is how the Dufek started. Manufacturing shifted by 1912 to other wood products, especially those cheese boxes. So did you guess which wood product is getting attention from the Guinness Book of World Records? It's the Dufek's charcuterie boards, with one recently named the largest ever, holding more than 760 pounds of gourmet cheese. That's one huge slice of whiskey. Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Busted pencils.
We'll keep talking about it because it is an important thing happening in our world and in our culture, whether you're in education or in any field. It's part of your day-to-day right now. Like, hey, what's the role AI is going to play in this?
We give every assignment the kids turn in, we put it through AI detectors. There's no ability for a student to opt out of the surveillance.
Busted Pencils, weeknights at 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. This is the Buzz of the North, WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. An Israeli security official telling ABC News that based on specific intelligence, there are wheels in motion for an Iranian attack on Israel in retaliation for a strike on the Iranian consulate in Syria that killed two Iranian generals. Schools and educational institutions remain closed across Israel, but hundreds are in the streets of Tel Aviv at this hour. Anti-Netanyahu protesters, as they have every weekend for months, calling for more to be done to return Israeli hostages being held in Gaza. A deadly attack at a Sydney, Australia shopping mall. Authorities say a man began stabbing shoppers, killing at least six people, wounding multiple others. New South Wales Police Commissioner Karen Webb.
But there's no suggestion that there was anyone targeted, but that could change, and we will only know that in time.
The suspect shot and killed by an officer. Jury selection in Donald Trump's New York criminal trial scheduled to start Monday morning. This is ABC News. Authorities in Central Florida looking into a suspected carjacking that may have been recorded on cell phone video. ABC's Daria Albinger with the many questions authorities have in this case.
She called her husband to tell him someone was following her and ramming their car into the back of her SUV. But Seminole County authorities say the woman, who is believed to have died in a carjacking, didn't call 911.
Why did she stop at the red light? There's a lot of things that we'll absolutely never know.
Sheriff Dennis Lemma.
This is a tragic incident, nevertheless.
Authorities believe a body found in a burning vehicle at a construction site is the woman who made that call. Daria Albinger, ABC News.
No arrests have been made. The fashion world is mourning the loss of Italian fashion designer